This is Dave Crippen, continuing our series of reminiscences of design executives at Ford Motor Company. This is the fourth day of June in 1984, and we're at the Ford Archives of the Henry Ford Museum, and we're speaking today with Gail Halderman, who is currently Director of Small Car Exteriors and Truck Design at Ford Motor Company. We'd like to ask Gail to review his career in design and styling, and particular emphasis of his career at Ford Motor Company.
Thank you, Dave. I guess my career in design started back in Dayton, Ohio, where I was going to art school and was studying art with Jonathan Winters, of all people, one of our leading comics, and hadn't really made up my mind yet whether I wanted to be a commercial artist or a car designer, but the further I studied and the more I learned why I had made up my mind that cars was really more intriguing, more of a challenge, and something that I could spend my lifetime doing and be satisfied with it. I left school 2 months before graduation and came to Ford Motor to look for a job. Was hired at Ford by Gene Bordenay, who at that time was head of Lincoln Mercury, and hired me as a Lincoln Mercury designer. I then went back to Dayton and told the school that I had received my job and I wanted to leave immediately and come to Detroit. And the dean said, "Wait a minute, you can't do that. There's still 2 months of school left." So I took my portfolio over to his office. He looked at it and said, "I'm quite impressed. It looks good to me, and I can understand why you're anxious to get up there." He said, "If you're willing to spend another 4 weeks with us, I'll leave you go 4 weeks early." So I came up and started to work. And Mr. Bordenay said, "Well, why don't you go upstairs? We have a little advanced group upstairs. Learn to get your pencils and your desk and get organized. And in about a week or two, I'll bring you down to Lincoln Mercury Studio and put you to work." Well, believe it or not, in that week and a half, I think, there was a crisis in Ford Studio. I was sent to Ford Studio instead and never went to Lincoln Mercury until I was named director of it. But so most of my career up until that time was spent on Ford cars and not the Lincoln Mercury cars. The first big assignment I had at Ford was working on the 57 new car. And it was just beginning. We were doing a few things for the 56. But that was another studio, and we were assigned a brand new 57 Ford. And we also designed the Mystère show car at the same time. We kind of did that on overtime, and then we worked on the 57 car during the day. But we were developing two clay models, I believe, at the time. We had one that was to the engineering package and size, one that was to our designer's liking, and it naturally was wider, lower, and a little bit longer. And at showtime, we took both of these models out, and naturally the management picked the designer's choice because it looked better. And go ahead.
Reminds me. That brings up a pertinent point. I hate to interrupt your narrative, but you spoke of the engineering package and being on package, and the designer's concept or package. Was there, at this point in time, in the late 50s, a competition between engineering and styling?
Well, back in the 50s, we were actually reporting to engineering. our reporting line of command was through the engineers. And naturally, they had man sitting up a little straighter in the car, a little more chair height. And we wanted to lay him down, sitting back in a little more relaxed atmosphere so we could lower the roof. And that was the biggest difference. And we also wanted to speed the windshield angle up a little bit and make the car a little bit more racy. And that was the biggest single difference. But so anyway, we worked on the 57 Ford, got it approved, got it into production, and then I continued on working on the Ford cars all the way through. We did the retractable hardtop. We did.
Can you tell us a bit about the retractable hardtop?
Well, the retractable hardtop actually was done. The mechanism and some of the key folding parts of it was done at the Continental Division at that time, but was then brought into us in our studio for final adaptation to the Ford. So we had to adapt this system to the Ford car, which was a tremendous job. It really, in all fairness, didn't fit that well, but we forced it to fit, and it turned out to be quite a wonder in its day, I think. So then from then on, I worked on from the 57, we worked on the 58 and the 59. The 58 was, by the way, a disaster car, I think.
What?
We had a beautiful 57, and we really didn't know what to do to it for 50 in the 58 line, so we really made it worse. We put in two taillights instead of one. We put in two headlamps instead of one. We just made it, we chromed the side. Remember, we put the corrugated gold aluminum on the side. We really messed that car up pretty bad. But then in 59, we changed to another all-new car and cleaned it up again somewhat, kept the general form of the 57. And that car was very successful.
Why?
It had a very sturdy look. It looked like it would do the job. And I think we fixed all the mistakes we made in 58. I think one of the most exciting cars we did in that era was the 60. We started really from scratch with a clean sheet of paper on the 1960 Ford car. We took an all-new approach to its theme. We cleaned up the car completely through the side. We didn't put the bulges in the concave sections. We kept it clean and sleek. And we thought that was a designer's type car, but unfortunately the public didn't like it as well as the 57 and the 59. But we worked on that car pretty hard. We modified it for 61. And in this era of the time, we changed the cars drastically every year. We didn't carry them like we do today, but we were changing them considerably every year. And in 1960, we made the 60 car look heavier, and it looked like it had much more trunk space. It appeared to have much more interior space, but it really didn't. We just made it look that way. And those were some pretty trying times back then. We, in order to design for those car lines, maybe we would create as many as a dozen clay models and take them all out for the show at the same time and pick and choose parts. This corner, this roof, that grill, this wheel opening, and then try to put them all together. And usually we'd end up with a camel and then we'd have to start over. But that's the way it was done back then. The management of the company liked to see a lot of proposals. They enjoyed letting the designers have their freedom, and then they liked to come over and pick and choose and marry together these components that didn't fit. And so that was a task that we had to contend with. And then once we got the basic shapes approved for any one particular car, then we had the derivative models to to work on, like the station wagons or the four doors or the two doors or the convertibles. And sometimes the original theme that was approved or selected wouldn't always lend itself very well to the station wagon or lend itself to the convertible. So we really earned our money back then trying to make these things happen. We went through some periods through this time where we were putting a lot of chrome on the cars. We were capping all the edges with moldings. We were surrounding everything with chrome, and we were going through two tones and even three tones of colors that sometimes didn't always go together that well. But we thought it was the right thing for the time, and they were exciting. And we had some car moldings that were going crossing over highlights and all kinds of funny things. But those were maybe the days that you look back and say, gosh, why did we do those? But at the time, they seemed like the right thing to do. I think from the end of the 60s, the thing that really impressed me and I spent a lot of time on, seemed to me like was probably the highlight of my career, was when we were assigned by Mr. Iacocca to take on a personal car. And we started doing a 2+2 kind of seating arrangement where the rear seat of the car was more of a jump seat for children, or maybe a little bit more cramped than what we were at that time used to even thinking about putting back there. And we worked on many, many cars, theme designs along this line. And at that time, we didn't know what it was going to be called. But after a couple years of many trial and error, this car became the Mustang. And we had, go ahead.
I wonder, Gail, if you could take us through that episode fairly step by step, so that we can get a pretty good picture from your experience as to how the Mustang evolved and who was involved in its creation, and how it became a marketing success.
Well, the car actually started out on the product planner's dream pad, I guess, as a new entry in the market for a segment that really nobody was selling to at that time. It was, we called it back then, a personal car. Something that you may just want to buy and drive to work or just drive to the grocery and not necessarily use it as a family or a weekend type vehicle. There were many trial and errors put together and changed and modified on the seating positions, because we'd never done a car that did not have a full rear seat. And it was very difficult for the company to even think about doing something that was less than that. We had tried them without rear seats, but none had a compromised rear seat. So this car had a compromised rear seat. And of course, in putting that together, the length of the wheelbase and how wide should it be and how high it should be was a major, major concern. So we did lots of studies. And we worked, by the way, with product planning. At that time, it was almost a single-handed project by Hal Sperlich. And he was almost a one-man show on that. Did most of the work himself, I think by himself. And I really, at that time, can't remember if there were any engineers assigned to it. I think it was Hal and a couple of us in design that took this on as a special little project that we did in the corner for a while. There were, I believe, about 12 various vehicles, all the same design, but of various dimensions looked at to try to settle down on what size the car should be. And out of that study, we finally ended up with the one that was chosen. But that was a major decision in the program. plus the fact that the company really didn't want to build this car. It was frowned upon by the board of directors. The top management didn't think we needed it. We really didn't have a place to build it at the time. And so it was really a battle for Hal Spurlick and his people and Mr. Iacocca to get the thing even onto the agenda at that time, because they didn't want to talk about it. Well, I think as the program progressed and we did get more serious about it, we realized that we really didn't have a good enough, the car didn't really look good enough. And so Mr. Bourdonnais at that time, who was in charge of design, called everybody together and he said that we were now serious about the program, that we were going to spend more time on the design of it, and everybody in the building was to give it a try. So we divided up into groups, and I think we ended up with four different groups or three different groups, and we each took this project on. And at the time I was in the Ford studio, we were so busy doing Ford cars that the only design time that I had to work on it was at home. So I went home and I sketched on this project, and actually the car was clay modeled from a sketch I did on my porch. So I feel a little bit like I had some basic part in the final design. But we showed these cars to the management. They were excited about them, and I think until that last show day when Mr. Ford came over and was really enthused about the looks of it, I think the car would not have made it. I think it was only because of its appearance that inspired the whole project. And we had also during that period of time an awful lot of rules of engineering's restrictions on what they could achieve. And I remember I kept tab that the original Mustang broke 77 of the company's rules at that time in order to manufacture it. So we, that also was another a new thought on the car. I think Hal Spurlick and Iacocca both thought that for once the car had to be sold as a complete automobile. We couldn't sell it with a base model and have a stripped down model and then end up charging more for carpeting, more for wheel covers, more for good seat trim, more for the best engine. And this car was done really with wheel covers as base. We had carpet throughout. We offered a convertible. We had, it was a full line of car. And I think it was the very first time that had ever been done. So that was a new era, in my opinion, in car design at Ford.
Do you have any thoughts about you described in some detail the process as it went from Hal Spurlick's original concept as a product planner to where it went from there in terms of the competition that you entered in, who won the competition, and some of the names and players involved in the whole operation. We've had a number of people saying that they were involved with the beginning of the Mustang. This would be a good time to set the record straight on.
Well, Dave, that's true. There were a lot of people that were involved in this, and I think the ones that were in the competition that didn't win probably deserve as much credit as those that few of us that did work on it that did. At the time, I was working for Dave Ash, who was working for Joe Horace, and Joe was really assigned this project to do. He put together a very small design team of about three or four of us to take on the design task. At the same time, Buzz Grissinger, who at that time was head of Lincoln Mercury Studio, was given the same assignment. He he put together a small team, and I can't remember. I think it might have been De La Rosa working for him at the time. But and they did a car that was very nice, by the way. And in fact, it would have been an excellent car. But out of the cars that were, I can't believe if there was a third car or not. I don't recall if there are two or three. But the car that was chosen was the car from Joe Orris's area that Dave Ash and I and I guess Charlie Faniff at that time, I don't know if you remember Charlie.
Yes.
We worked on and we really did it on a crash basis. We did it on weekends, Saturdays, Sundays, and a few all-nighters just to pull this thing together. And it was interesting because when we actually didn't know at the time what an impact this car was going to make. We didn't have any competition at the time in the market. As the time grew nearer and nearer for production and introduction, why naturally the public relations people kept saying, hey, now we want your original sketches you did. We want to see the car as it started. We want to see the models that were rejected. We didn't have them, so we created some. We actually went back and started and did some sketching. We did some tapes. We ended up taking a full-size metal car and covered it with clay and put it into the styling bridge and scraped it down to the metal car, and they filmed it in that manner, so it looked like we created this car. And it worked fantastically, by the way. We another story about the Mustang, which I think is interesting. We, for the first time in Design Center, we elected to build one that had an engine in it. Now, we never do this, but back then, for some reason, we had to have one. So we took a small car and a chassis and created a Mustang with an engine in it. And Joe Orris kept asking me day after day, when will that car be ready? When are we going to get it? Is it out of the shop yet? And naturally it wasn't. And the day that it came out of the shop, which was on a Friday, nearly finished, why, Ford Division came over in a panic. And they said, we need to borrow a car this weekend for some early photography of the Mustang. And I didn't at the time have a car that was available other than this one that just came out of the shop. So I gave it to them with the promise that I would have it back Monday morning, because I was so sure that Orris was just anxious to see it. Well, they took that car, they sent it to Arizona. It was used in the original Mustang commercials. They cut the roof off and they made convertibles out of it. They painted it about five times. I never got that car back. And the amazing thing was that Joe never asked me where it was. But that was an exciting time in my period of design.
What kind of, of course, at your level, you may not have been able to catch all of these, but what kind of, once Iacocca decided on to go ahead with Spurlock's original concept, and then your team came up with the final styling and design concept, where did it go from there in terms of acceptance by the corporation?
Okay. Well, after we had what was given the nod for the general appearance, we still didn't know at that time how much the car cost. We didn't know where it was going to be built. We didn't even really know for sure whether it could be built. So we had to spend a considerable amount of time redoing the car, what we call going through the feasibility stage, making sure that it was feasible, could be manufactured, was on cost, something we could afford. And I would guess it took 3 months to do that. And it was then after those days when we got to that stage, it went before the final approval committee, because they then had enough information to deal with the facts.
Who was on that committee?
I'm guessing, I guess, but I would have to say Ernie Breach, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Crusoe still there?
Crusoe, I'm not sure about Crusoe.
No, he departed by then.
No,
yeah.
I think McNamara. Maybe. Charlie Beecham, I think, was in the marketing area at that time.
Right.
And of course, Iacocca, Don Fry.
Don Fry.
I think that's all I can think of. Chase Morrissey, maybe. Yeah.
You mentioned a moment ago that HF2 finally came in, and were you at that session when he gave his final approval?
You know, Dave, I don't think I was.
But it would have had to have been he and Iacocca finally.
Yes.
Said,
no, it was Mr. Ford definitely who gave us the okay to go further at that time. And the unbelievable thing is that car cost the company, I understand, around $60 million to build, and that seemed like a lot of money back then. But comparing that to today, we can't even tool four doors for that. So,
really?
Yeah. So it's amazing how cheap things were back then.
We bring you through your career with the later Mustangs after the success of the 64.
Okay.
As we all know, there was considerable fiddling with the basic design concept, and I believe you had a very large hand in the Mustangs that came a year or two later.
Yes, I did. I worked on probably all the Mustangs up through, I guess, the 60 almost, and I'm still working on them. The dilemma that the designers had, and the company, I believe, after the first one, was that they didn't know what to do with it. They didn't really want to change it. They didn't want to touch it. But they also knew they had to. It had to be modified, to be freshened. We had heard by then that GM and Chrysler both were doing cars. They were going to compete against it, so we had to freshen the Mustang. We had started two or three models on various degrees of change. Some quite radical, some were very conservative. And I was being directed back then by Joe Orris, who wanted to change it considerable, and he wanted to take the concave off the side and make it a convex shape. And I wanted to make the side deeper and make it take a feature that we'd started and make it more so the next time. We had quite a controversy over that, and he didn't want to give, and of course naturally I didn't, but since he was the boss, why I would have done what he wanted. But we had a two-sided car back then. One side was the way he wanted it, and one side was the way I preferred it. And Spurlick was very dead against the direction Joe wanted to go. He wanted to go the way I wanted to go and make the features stronger the second time up. So he called Iacocca on the phone, and he said that we had a dilemma on the design. He thought we needed a meeting with him to come over and review the options. And so Lee came over with Charlie Patterson one night about 5 o'clock.
Who was
at that time in charge of manufacturing, I believe. I'm not positive, but I know Don Fry was there. And so we were looking at the two sides and the two sides of the roof and all kinds of things. And naturally, we looked at the convex side first, that instead of taking air in, let the air out, supposedly. And Iacocca said that he really didn't care much for that. He didn't think that resembled the Mustang, and it was a different car. So So then we walked around, and Lee saw the site that I was trying to sell, and he loved it, liked it, approved it on the spot. And so then we moved on to the roof design, and we also had two designs on that. And he said, well, I definitely like the side that's on the side that I just liked. And so again, they chose my design. And so from then on, I guess I was tagged as being the Mustang designer, and I've been working on them mostly ever since.
What was that model?
That was a 57.
And how did it distinguish it from the original?
Well, we took the features that...
You say 57, you mean?
67. Excuse me, I'm 10 years off. We took the features of the original car, and we tried to make them stronger. We tried to make the front end stronger with a little bigger mouth, stronger grill area. We tried to strengthen the lamps. We tried to strengthen the side. We made the pillar a little bit bigger, C-pillar bigger. We made the tail lamps a little larger. So it looked like a little bit more car. And that was the philosophy behind it, was to give the same car, but just a little more. The 59, when we started the 59 change, we sort of used the same philosophy. Was again try to continue the cues that had been established, but make them more modern, update them a little bit. And in 69, I believe, we eliminated the big 5x7 headlamp, and we went with two small ones. We elected to put one in the fender and one in the grill, and we then elected to change the body side from a concave section to something that was more of a convex or a flush section. But that car, telling a little bit about Mustangs, we approved that model. If I recall, that model was approved by Bunky Knudsen in a snowstorm outside.
Is this the 70 design?
Yeah, 69 or 70.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're quoted in a magazine article saying it's 1970.
Okay, it might have been. And we, at that time when Mr. Knudsen came, he was quite impressed with the Mustang car. He had talked about the fact that GM had never really hit that market, that we were fortunate that we had it, and we should never lose it. And so he put a lot of time and effort into the Mustang lineup, and of course he had his own theories as to what the car should be and what could be done to make it even better. But he never really changed its philosophy. He thought the original philosophy was right, that we should just continue it.
And what was it?
A personalized car that was really, even the base model was complete. You didn't have to buy your way up to make it a good car for you. You didn't have to buy wheel covers separate in those days. You didn't have to buy a deluxe trim to get a decent seat trim. Even though we were starting to get a higher grade interior, like we had performance packages and we had options in the engines and things to be better, but the base car was still a very good car. So
About this time, you were quoted as saying that you are beginning to get a little restive about the changes in the original car. The changes that were coming on after 1968. Is that still true? Did you find yourself a little out of sync with some of the changes that were ongoing?
I think that's true, Dave. We found that there was a different approach being done by GM and a little different approach being done by Chrysler, and some even the foreign cars in this market were probably a little more modern in some aspects, and so we wanted to really take on an all-new car. and start from scratch and get some of the features that would make it smoother, slicker, faster windshields that had folding seats and hatchbacks and would bring it really up to speed. So that's when we got off into some advanced projects that developed a then turned into the 80 car. But those the basic principles really never and still are still intact.
The Knudsen era, which you described as having a beneficial effect on, did he continue the growth? Did he accelerate the growth of the Mustang into a much different kind of concept car than you had? What was called, I believe, you called it the secretary's car at one point.
Well, if secretaries are a personal car.
Yeah.
Well, I think Bunky Knudsen saw greater things for the Mustang. He thought that the Ford Motor Company wasn't taking advantage of it, and he was trying to promote it into a different segment, broaden its appeal, do anything he could. Because really, even yet today, it's the best name we have in the company. And I think that he made us all sit back and take a second look at it and do a better job. And we got some of that with us yet today. I think we're still trying to broaden that.
The later Mustangs, which you were heavily involved in, were you working with the designer stylist that Mr. Knudsen brought in, Larry Shinoda?
Larry, yes. His job at the time was to, after the theme was approved, Larry took it through the feasibility part, and unfortunately, Larry at that time had some different ideas, and he didn't want to continue the original theme, and he'd try to change it, and being a good friend of Mr. Knudsen's, well, he'd call him at night and talk about it, and we'd come in the next morning, and the side of the car would be changed. And then we'd have to go back and get that all sorted out. And a couple times we won, and a couple times he won. He convinced Mr. Knudsen that his way was better. But I think it was an honest effort, really, to try to be helpful and to get across what Larry Shinoda thought was more the GM way of doing business, and we weren't used to it. Larry's still a good friend of mine. I see him occasionally. I think he's a good designer. Tough to work with, but
on the whole, the reactions we've gotten from other interviewees that the Knudsen Shinoda era had a sort of a negative effect on Ford design. But that's not necessarily the case.
Well, the Knudsen Shinoda era was different, and I think. From my side of it, I think Mr. Knudsen did Ford Motor Company a lot of good. I think he came in, he told us from the very beginning that looking across town at Ford, that we had excellent designs, we had good product plans, we had good products. The only biggest single factor was that we approved our designs too late and that we played with them too long and changed them too many times before production, and that he was going to help make the design approval and be there and help make it stick and not change it every week and keep it on track. And I think he had a very good point. He also told us a few things about how GM was planning to do hatch hoods, putting a grill panel in front of the hood, and so when you want to change your car, you can just change the grill panel, and you then don't have to change the fender and the hood all the time to get a difference. And that was, I think, one of the biggest single things in design that he came and showed us how to do it. And he also had some GM rules on how high the front fender ought to be in relationship to the rear quarter, and he would measure them with his belt line as he would walk along the car, and if it didn't match this guideline, well, he would reject it. But I think there were good rules, really, and I found him to be inspirational, as much as Iacocca, but they were just different.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, at the time, there was rather vicious power struggle going on between he and Iacocca.
Well, I was going to mention that, Dave. We had in our building at the time, you probably have heard this, we had Iacocca cars and we had Knutson cars for the same program. Designed similar but different, just for the character of these two men. And when we knew that one was coming, we'd show one car, and when the other one was coming, we'd show his car. And, you know, I don't recall but what we would have done if they came together, but that's absolutely true. They really, as different as the two men were, when I did see them together, they didn't disagree. They seemed to have general good philosophy about cars. And I think it was unfortunate we lost both of them. I think if we could have kept both of those men working together, we'd have had a terrific team. Knutson was, I think, a super engineer, a good product man. And I think Lee was really the best as far as salesmen go.
Before we leave the Mustang, which you played a large part, can you tell us a bit about the evolution of the very popular Boss Mustang, the so-called 302s and the 429s, and maybe you can take us step by step through that process?
The person who can tell you most about the Boss Mustang was Larry Shinoda, because the Boss name was his idea. He created the Boss Mustang really from an idea that he wanted to do on all cars. And I don't know whether he personally elected to change the design to that, but he had modified a car to this configuration, and it was somewhat rejected by the committee in general. But he convinced Mr. Knutson that it was good and it should be called something special. And he said, I think it ought to be the Boss. And from that, the Boss name appeared. And
so it was a buzzword of the 60s, wasn't
it? Was
it
was a buzzword of the 60s.
Especially among youth.
It had a hot engine, it performed well, and by the way, I thought it looked pretty good. But that's how it happened. It was kind of a shock to us at the time that it happened that way. It wasn't the normal way of doing business at Ford.
Well, at this time, you're the design executive. First, you're the executive stylist at the Ford Studio, and of course, your main responsibility is getting out the Ford models each year. The Mustang was sort of an interlude for you, but an interesting and pleasant one,
yes.
Of which you contributed quite a bit of input. And then in the late 60s, you're design executive with the Vehicle Design Group, and by this time you have a design center. Can you tell us a bit about how the styling office evolved into the design center in the mid-50s? I'm sorry, the early 60s.
Okay, well, let me step back, I think. The design department, when I joined the company, really reported to body engineering, or to the engineering group. And we were called stylists, and they were called engineers. And we had George Walker, and he had two people. One was Elwood Engel, and one was Joe Orris, who worked for him as consultants. And we really desperately needed a leader. And I think Mr. Ford realized that, and Mr. Breach. So they appointed George Walker then, about a year and a half after I joined the company, to be vice president in charge of design. At that time, he brought Elwood Engel and Joe Orris into the company. and Joe Horace was in charge of Ford cars in the Ford studio, and Elwood Engel was kind of a staff designer, and I guess you'd call him a consultant, and he just worked on any project that seemed to be hot and needed work or needed help, and George Walker would ask him his opinion, and he didn't have a staff at that time other than maybe one or two people. During the George Walker days, we were still known as Stylus. When he retired, we were then, Gene Bournet became vice president, and the role of the designer really changed. I think we, instead of just doing pretty sheet metal around Givens, why we became more involved in the size of the car and what the package should be and the kind of car it should be, and we became probably more of marketers and engineers and salesmen and designers. We really took on a more broader role. We thought then that our name was wrong from Stylus. We wanted to be called designers that encompassed a bigger role. So we actually got our building and our names and everything changed from the Styling Center to the Design Center. So I don't remember the year that happened, but
early 60s
could be. So I don't remember the year that happened, but
early 60s
could be.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Do you attribute some of this change to Gene Bournet, his efforts along that line?
I do. I really do. I think we decided that our role was more. We had a bigger role in the product planning, and we could help make those decisions for the planner by being able to show not only something on paper that was graphic, but a three-dimensional tool to work with and help decide what products and what market we should be doing that nobody else in the company could do. And you can type this out on paper, but until you actually see it and can touch it, it's very difficult to determine whether you like it or not. And so we really felt our role was a bigger role than we'd ever maybe had imagined at one time. We were also able to, I think, help engineering. We did a lot of things that were at their guidance. We did things at their request that they could make their job easier, the different types of bumpers and different ways of doing windshields. And we would take on these requests and try to make them look good and also make them better for the company. We could save money. And we're still doing that today, by the way. I guess we have the lead role in determining how cars are put together and how cars are assembled, made.
You still maintain that that role today?
Yes, very much.
How you spoke of Hal Halsberg as being a prime example of a product planner. Can you give us some idea of how the product planner fitted into this design process? How it evolved?
Well, the product planner's role is a funny role in any company. Their role is anywhere from maybe a dreamer to a final policeman to make sure that everything is going on schedule. But basically, their role is to plan the vehicle, plan the product, plan the price it ought to be, plan the market it should be aimed for. It needs to be determined whether we can make it, where it should be made, and how many series and colors and options it should have to end up naturally to make money. That's the designer or the product planner's role. Hal Sperlich, back in the early days when I worked with him very close, was probably one of the most brilliant planners that I've ever dealt with. Now, Hal could go and he could dream up more ideas and more ways of doing any single problem that you can dream of. Now, he could come in with 25 ideas, and I would guess out of the 25, 23 were lousy, but there were two or three that were just brilliant, and they were fabulous. And I hate to say this, but Hal didn't know the difference. But there were other people that did. And one of them was I. Cook. Hal, not only he was a very inspiring, he had a lot of inspiring ideas to a designer. He would come in and look at your creation that was being done and say, gosh, that gives me an idea. And he would take off and come back the next day with 10 variations of that, which not only was good, but it gave you then some variations and some additional thoughts that you could do. So he worked very well with a creative person. And I think that he looked at designers as a challenge. We were creative, and I think he was creative. And although we were doing it in three dimension and in clay, he was doing it in writing, and he took it on as a challenge. I think he was still one of the most creative. Right now, our planners are doing, I think, excellent planning, but they're basically being told what to do, and then they implement. They're becoming implementers, and not creative.
You have then the body engineers, and could you explain how this process worked at Ford? Was Don Fry a engineer or a product planner?
Don Fry is a chemistry doctor in chemistry, I believe, and his career started, I believe, in research. But yes, basically, he's an engineer. And, you know, a very good one. He thoroughly understands all the aspects of engineering. I believe he crossed over and became a planner almost by accident, you know. And Don and I worked together very closely on a few projects, and he kept admitting to me that he was sure glad that he had someone around who knew the aesthetics of cars, because he didn't. But after about a week or two, he soon decided he knew as much as we did. So,
untypical experience.
Right. Don Fry was responsible for the Shaker Hood Mustang, and he was responsible for, I believe, the Shelby. Those were some of his ideas, concepts to broaden the car and make it a more exciting car. And I was with him the day he decided not to do the Shelby, but to do it in-house, take it away from Shelby, and call it something else. And so we called it then the GT, and dropped the name Cobra. And that was a tough decision for Don.
Can you, did you have any input into the Shelby episode at all? Can you enlighten us a bit on that?
I had input, Dave, only on the last couple models of the Shelby. In all fairness, the Shelby was done probably correctly, where a car was given to Shelby and he did his own version to begin with. And the car was then brought in and shown, and Carroll Shelby presented it. He said, here's what I think you should do. And the company said, fine, we'll do that. In the latter years, when the Shelby then naturally became popular, we decided that we wanted to design the Shelby ourselves. So we would do some proposals for the Shelby version, and then have him come in and look at our versions, and hopefully he would agree. So we were doing them in reverse after that. So yeah, I worked on the last couple models, and went up to, the last ones were built in Ionia, Michigan. And
why was that?
They were built by A.O. Smith in Ionia.
Oh.
And I went up there with De La Rosa a couple times to look at the progress and the cars. And they had an assembly line in an old, old factory that was, I'm sure, torn down by now. But that's where the last ones were done. Yeah.
Shelby's rather charismatic character in automotive, if not styling, automotive concept mm-hmm. concepts of certain sporty cars. Did he have an impact on the later Mustangs in terms of the derivative?
I think Carroll Shelby had a big influence, not only on the Mustang, but other cars we were doing. He was probably a pretty shrewd businessman. I think he was nothing more than a hot rod race car driver who found out that he could sell his talent to a big corporation. And I think we probably ended up making him a lot of money, and he, in turn, helped Ford Motor Company. I think we learned some things from him, and maybe the timing was right. And I think, in all fairness, that after when he left, we probably used all we could from him. But he's now, I think, doing a good job for Chrysler. He's making their car something different.
Interesting that, we'll get to this a little bit later, interesting that Shelby and Sperlick ended up at Chrysler and now working for Iacocca.
Yeah.
We've got you in your the chronology of your career. We've got you now in the mid-60s. The Mustang is a success, and the and its successors are coming along beautifully, and you're working on those. What else in the mid-60s and up to about the decade of the 70s, what else are you working on at this point?
Well, we were doing all the Ford cars as well. I mean, we went through a period through there where we had Fairmonts and Falcons and Fairlane 500s and, you know, Galaxies. And there was a matrix of Ford cars that all seemed to come and go and were all there at the same time. I was working on all of those during that period. And the one year that really rang a bell with me was, let me make this story a little bit shorter. I was one time, maybe I'm ahead of myself, but I was promoted to director of truck design. Then, I was only there about 6 months, was then, by I think Bucky Knudsen's direction, moved to be head of Lincoln Mercury Studio. And after a couple years of there, Bordenay said, "Well, Gail," he said, "I want you now back to Ford Studio to head up the Ford cars." They were working on the 72 or 73, I believe the 73 or 4 model year at that time, and they couldn't seem to get a car designed that management liked. Iacocca didn't like it. There was a dilemma on really what the car should be. We didn't know what Chevrolet was doing for sure. It was a terrible indecision period. And so I was moved to Ford Studio and was given the task that in 3 weeks we had to have a car approved by the design committee, or we were not going to have a new car. Time had passed, and we were either going to have to continue what we had or get a car in 3 weeks. So I spent some time with Bordenay, and we discussed the car a little bit, and he outlined what he thought it should be, and I talked a little bit about what I thought it should be, and we went down and reviewed the progress, what had been started, and he told me that two things. He said, "You've got 3 weeks to come up with a design. I don't like anything we've just seen. And by the way, I'm going to Europe." And when I get back, which happens to be the day of the meeting, I expect you to have two models. One, a base model, which we call a control model, and then a high series version, ready for approval. And I think it should be something that could be approved, and we can get this car in production. So naturally, we worked day and night and went through a ton of designs and alterations and worked long hours. And on the day of the meeting, we were finished. We had our two cars. I was waiting patiently to show the cars to Bournet. He saw me in the hall and he said, "Gail, I know you want to show me what you've got, but I'm late already for another meeting and I can't see them." So we had them in the showroom and they were ready for show, and he did not see those cars until everybody walked in together. Uh-huh. And we got both cars approved.
And they were?
I think the 73 or 4 Ford, 73 Ford, I believe.
And what distinguished those models from previous models?
Well, what we did, we took on the approach, basically, that they should look like Ford products. What was being done prior to that were strange-looking cars that looked probably more like GM cars than Ford cars. And that was one thing that Bournet said, we've got to make these cars appear to be, they've got to look like Fords. A little bit of the old Ford cues and a little bit of the Ford look. And believe me, there is a Ford look. And so we just took this at hand and just decided to make them have all those features that we could. And they never changed. And I can't remember whether Bournet told me he liked them after that or said I did a good job. But anyway, it was kind of a miracle job.
What were some of the distinctive series names of this period that you employed?
Well, the biggest single name that came along was when we had Galaxy, which was a big name. But I think the biggest one was LTD. When we introduced the LTD, I believe in the early part of the 60s, it was primarily a distinction for the interior. And we put in a luxury interior that was probably better than what we put in Lincoln's. At the time, we called it our limited series, and it sold like gangbusters. And it wasn't long before GM had to follow suit. And that's when they came along and called the car Caprice at the same time. And we haven't really dropped LTD yet.
It's become a bread and butter item for you at the moment.
Oh, really? Right.
Yes.
So, I was just going to say, where am I now?
I would like to ask you a couple of questions about, was this the seasoning process to get you, you were briefly at Truck and Tractor and a little longer at the Lincoln Mercury Design Office. Was that a deliberate attempt to give you a broader experience in?
I guess so, Dave. I think that all of us are taken through the chairs, as they call it, and my tour of duty back then in Truck Studio was really relatively short, and I was working with Phil Caldwell. He was then head of trucks, and
how did you find him as a person to work for?
Phil was fine. He was delightful to work with. A little indecisive. He pondered longer over decisions than, say, Iacocca. He wanted a little more facts. He wanted to know more about it before he made a decision. Iacocca would say, "We got to do it, that's it, let's go." Phil had a couple rules, by the way, that I've got changed. He had a rule that in truck operations, he was to be shown nothing that wasn't already gone through the planning process, the engineering process, the cost and the marketing. He wanted to know exactly what part of the marketing it was going to be in. He wanted all the homework done and then show it to Phil. And this was the rules that they followed. And I said to Phil that I thought he was being shortchanged in our area, that he wasn't given the opportunity to even see the alternatives, that maybe something was being worked on all through these stages of a choice that one of his guys would make that he didn't agree with. And he said, I didn't realize that, and I'll change the rule. So he did. But we got along fine. But unfortunately, in that little bit of time I was in trucks, why, I was given an assignment to do two cars. And by Mr. Knutson. And he came along and asked me to do two cars.
What were they?
Oh, gosh. They might have been Torinos, I believe. But Phil Caldwell didn't like the idea that I was supposed to be paid to do trucks, and instead I was doing two automobiles. And then shortly after that, I was moved from trucks to Lincoln's, Lincoln Mercury. But
how did your sojourn at Lincoln Mercury turn out? Did you enjoy it?
Well, I'll tell you one more thing about my assignment at trucks.
Please.
When Mr. Bournet told me I was going to trucks, I said to him, what should I... How do I work now through you? In other words, what do you want me to bring to you? What do you want to see? What decisions can I make? And Bournet's comment was, I only have one request. That is, don't ever let Phil Caldwell call me. And that was my direction. Then after all that happened, by the way, I said to Bournet one day, I said, do you remember back when I was given a truck job, you gave me that statement. I said, did Phil Caldwell ever call? And he said, yes, he did. And I said, really? Hold on. I said, I thought I did a good job. He said, he called me when I called him, or when he found out you were being transferred out of trucks. So I thought that was a compliment. So...
Was Bournet more or less orchestrating your movements at this point? He was VP for design after,
yes,
George Walker had left, and pretty much the overall styling.
I think between
design.
Bournet and I, Coke and
Bournet. I see, yeah. Caldwell, you mentioned him as head of truck. Is that the head of the whole truck division
truck,
at that time?
Truck operations.
Truck operations. Yep. Had he been to Ford of England yet?
Or no, no. This is
before long
that.
Before. Okay,
this is
fine.
Before that. At that time, he wasn't the vice president.
He was simply a director.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we've got you then. How did your experience at Lincoln Mercury turn out? Did you find it?
I like Lincoln Mercury because, number one, I had never worked on the Lincoln Mercury cars, and it's fun, by the way, for a designer to work on some cars that can afford to do things. When you're working on the Ford Division cars, you're restricted a lot by what they can afford. It's kind of neat to be able to do Lincolns and Marks, for instance, and be able to spend some money. But we were doing, my first assignment there was, I think, the Montego car line, when we were introducing the intermediate car line series. And we were doing some intermediates. We also did some new Mercurys, we did some new Lincolns, and the most exciting, really, it was another exciting adventure along with the Mustang, was I was responsible for doing the Mark 6, which I think is one of the best Marks we ever did. And that car started out as a smaller car. It was being planned and programmed to be a much smaller in length and width than it turned out. It was going to be built on the A body. Instead, they had to put it on the X because of Wixom, because of the plant problem. It got bigger. And it really went from what I thought was a cute small car into a nice but a big car. And
This was in what year? Or years?
Well, this is a Mark 6. 79, 78.
How many years were you planning it? About 5 years?
I'd say at least three or four.
3 or 4 years.
Yeah. So that was really one of the highlights in my Lincoln Mercury experience. Mm-hmm. And of course, we did some Cougars, which were exciting.
Mm-hmm. Did you work on the original Cougar?
Didn't work on the original one, Dave. That was done by Buzz Grissinger.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been the Lincoln Mercury designer for a long time and had established pretty much the Lincoln Mercury, the Mercury's anyway, look back through the 50s and 60s and early part of the 70s. And so I continued his job, and he really then ended up replacing me in truck before he retired. Yeah. Yeah, when I went to Lincoln Mercury, he left, we switched jobs.
Well, we have you then, Gene Barnes asked you to come back to the Ford Design Office in the early 70s.
Right.
And he says we need you back there. So for effectively about 3 years, you were the chief Ford Design Executive. Then.
Right.
And how did what resulted from that?
Well, that's when we did the 73 Ford was the first project I did. And of course, from then on, we did all the 73s, the 75s, 6s, 7s. Those were tough years, they really were, because we were then doing Fairmonts, Torinos. When Bill Innes was head of North American operations and GM came out with their Monte Carlo, we did not have a Monte Carlo. So Bill Innes came over and he talked to me and he said, we have got to have a Monte Carlo car. We're losing too much market. So what can you do to develop a Monte Carlo? And he said, you look at the spectrum that we have and pick a car that you think we should build it from, but I really think it should either be a Montego or a Torino. Now he said, after you think about that, let me tell you that you've only got a few weeks to do something because we got to go fast. So we elected to do a Torino car. And we put together an all-new front end, and we put together new quarters and new rears and some roof treatment. He came over, looked at the car, and thought it was great. He at that time called Matt McLaughlin, who was head of sales, and he says, hey, Matt, I wanted to show you this vehicle. It's fantastic. This is exactly our fighter for Monte Carlo. And Matt came over and says, I don't like it. And Bill couldn't believe it. So anyway, parts of that car were incorporated in the next year's change for Torino. Innes then came back about a couple months later, and he said, we still got to do a Monte Carlo car. We don't have time to do an all-new one. Now, yeah, I know you did the one before, but we got to do it again. Now I've got sales, they understand my problem. So this time we took a Montego instead of a Torino and did it all over again. We had a little more of an extensive change, but we then called it the Torino Elite, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that car almost overnight. It was done in just a couple weeks. But that was, those were some very pressure days, I'd say.
How did the Elite fare?
Did very well.
Did very well for a short period.
Oh,
huh?
Yeah. It really did very well.
Did it help counter the Monte Carlo success?
I don't know if it countered the Monte Carlo. I think the market out there was so big for that kind of car. We did real well with the car. I don't think we hurt them, but I don't think it. I think we got a big chunk of it.
Mm-hmm. At this point, you seem to have a switch in your career. You, presumably, Bordenay, still orchestrating your movements, has asked you to go into the Advanced Vehicle Design Office.
Yeah.
How did that come about, and what did it entail?
Well, I went over to Advanced, and I was working then, I think, for De La Rosa for a short time.
Don De La Rosa.
And we worked on all cars. And Bordenay felt that somebody should be designing the vehicles and letting the production, or the Ford studio and the Lincoln Mercury studio, be more entailed in the all the production problems at hand. And they were doing mostly grills, ornamentation, and taillights. And we were really responsible for designing the all new shapes and configurations of the cars. So we took on, I'm trying to think what projects, some of the new Thunderbirds. We did the new Thunderbirds over there.
What years were those?
72, I think. Threes, fours, maybe. But we did a lot of Thunderbird projects. We did some Lincoln projects. We took on Mustang again. We took on some Ford cars. We really developed the bodies for most of all the car lines. And that was, I think, a highlight in my day too, because that was exciting, because we really had a big hand in the product planning. We naturally didn't always agree, and so we'd do pretty much what we wanted, and they'd come over and say, hey, that looks better than what we had in mind. So anyway, we were really working with Iacocca, doing, I think, the company's planning and design in one action, which...
This was a novel concept at Ford, was it not, at that time?
Well...
Had there been an advanced design studio before?
Yeah, there had been, but they weren't very successful. We, at one time, created a separate studio that was headed by Dave Ash, as what Bordenay then called, let's take a third look. And he used that as his third look, he said. But it really wasn't what this studio was. This studio was designed to really do the body shapes and the main bodies for all the cars in the company. So that's what we did. And those were good days.
At what stage in the design process did this come? Were you visionaries reaching out for advanced concepts?
Well, but I'd call it more pre-production. Advanced, but not beyond reality. So they were reasonable. They were something we could afford.
Feasible.
And they were on the books to be done in the next time around.
You enjoyed this because it gave you a certain freedom from the day-to-day operations of putting together a car line.
Well, we were, in all fairness, I was getting tired doing wheel covers and taillights, but yeah. Plus the fact that it was more creative, more enjoyable. We talked to the top planners who were planning the 10-year cycle plans daily, and we influenced their thinking quite a bit. And unfortunately, we don't have that today. We're not doing that.
I want to talk to you about that a little bit later. Then apparently this was reasonably successful because you became director of the Advanced International Vehicles Design Office. Now, how did that operate as opposed to what you've done a couple of years previous?
Well, it was about the same, Dave, except I got the international assignment, which was in dealing with not only Canada, but how these cars would relate to the Ford products in the world. We did some proposals for Australia. We did an Australian car, and during this period we sent some designs to Ford of Europe for their consideration, and I don't think we really influenced their designs much, but anyway, we were involved, and we might have turned them a little bit.
That brings up an interesting point. At this point, Ford of Europe is beginning to come into its own in terms of having influence not only on American styling, but
yes,
but
you've had some pretty good successes in the foreign field as well. Did you work as a team, or was that pretty much a separate organization before you added this to your portfolio?
Well, it was a separate organization, but it fell under Mr. Bourdonnais's authorization. And even though the cars in Europe and other countries should be somewhat, I think, designed for their market, we still had some influence as to trends. We were doing things manufacturing-wise, and we were doing things design-wise that they should be picking up. And so we influenced them that way. We I think, maybe taught them curved glass and hard-top door construction. And some of this that I guess you learn from, and they taught us a few things too, by the way. But having a exchange of ideas is good for the company. So
the things like the Capri were brought over from this from Ford of Europe.
Now the Capri is one that we did here. The original Capri was designed here in Dearborn, sent to Ford of Europe, and then naturally they reconstructed the car and then designed for their engineering and manufacturing. But the theme came from here, and I can't think of, there might have been a couple more, but that's one good example.
Stands out, glad you mentioned it. So you're in the mid-70s, and you've got a crisis looming on the horizon. The downsizing principle is beginning
Well, before that, the bumpers came.
All right, fine. Let's talk about the bumpers. The federal regulation.
The federal bumper rulings came in, and we really, in all fairness, did not know how to handle it. There were a lot of ideas on what the company could do and what we could do as designers to make these regulations not only work but also look good. So we went through piles and piles of ideas, a lot of drawings. We took Mr. Iacocca through sections and rules and what we had to do to meet the rules, and we showed him drawings of what it required, and every time he'd say, "That looks good, I think that's no problem at all, we should be able to live with that. Now when can I come back and see it on the car?" And we'd have him come back in a couple of weeks, and he'd say, "That's not what you showed me. That looks like hell. You know, it's terrible." And so then we decided we couldn't show drawings to the upper management, that we had to then start actually putting bumpers on the cars.
Right.
And from where we were back in those early days, these bumpers looked like truck bumpers. They looked heavy. They didn't fit. They weren't built into the designs. And so we had some very terrible, tough, long nights, believe me, on fixing bumpers. And some of them were not very good, I'll have to admit. And it's nobody's real fault. I think that we as the company didn't know how to meet the regulations any other way. So that was a tough one. And then from there, I think we got into another tough one on the government regulations, and that's called the seat belts.
Mm-hmm.
I would guess that the company has spent billions of dollars, millions on trying to do a decent seat belt system, and I don't think we have it yet.
Ford was a pioneer in the safety package.
Back in 56, we had pioneered a safety package.
Mm-hmm.
Had deep dish steering wheels and seat belts and safety controls and a lot of features, but the public was not willing to sacrifice. Didn't want belts on the seats to sit on, and we didn't know then how to stow them out of the way. So we suffered through that. Yeah, I worked with Bill Burnett on that project. Remember Bill Burnett?
And he was?
Bill Burnett at that time was the chief vehicle engineer, an old Cadillac engineer. Came from Cadillac to Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with him on those safety projects.
Then
you asked me what else? Before the bumpers?
I'm not sure.
Oh, downsizing.
Then the whole downsizing principle. And I'm sure you had a large role in that.
Well, downsizing was really almost a disaster to the designers, because for years the way we made our cars look better was to make them longer and lower. And for someone to make them arbitrarily taller and shorter was almost we did not handle that. So I would have to admit that I guess our first trials were pretty bad. They looked like cars that had been clipped and chopped, and we had to learn how to handle this. And now it's funny, downsizing, we're all in favor of downsizing. We think that it's almost easier now to do smaller cars than it is to make them bigger. They get heavy and clumsy now, and we've also learned how to cope with downsizing. You then have to invent more glass, lower belt lines, you get lower cowl and hood lines to offset the shorter length. And once you start learning how to play the proportions, it's no problem. But we struggled for years on that, I think a couple years anyway, to make it successful.
Interesting that that you chopped rather than sculpt in those days.
Well, we thought we were sculpting, but looking back, I guess we chopped. Mm-hmm. You know? You also, as you're doing this, you got to remember that you tend to want to keep a ground or a base to work from, and you don't want to take the car and totally destroy it. So you then take it bits and pieces. You say, well, okay, if I take 6 inches, it won't hurt it that much. You convince yourself. And then you say, well, I'll take 6 off the front, 6 off the back. It doesn't look that bad. And you look back, they're pretty bad.
Hal Sperling at this point was an outspoken advocate of downsizing at Ford, was he not?
Yes.
And he experienced some rather odd vicissitudes.
Well, I think Hal Sperling had the foresight, by the way, probably more so than any other single person, that downsizing was a way that we had to go, and it was the way the times were going to go, and that we could really design smaller cars that had the same amount of volume. It would be less weight, cheaper to produce, and more beneficial to us. And he had one tough struggle to convince not only, I think, his management, but upper management in this theory. And I think the higher in the company you get, the more difficult it is for you to recognize somebody else's ideas, maybe. And I think Hal was really one of the pioneers that believed us. And unfortunately, he lost his job over it. He was very strong in recommending that we look into smaller cars right from the very beginning. And in all fairness to the company, we probably launched the very first downsizing action in the whole domestic line, called Fairmont Zephyr. And we forget that we really were the first in that market, but in fairness, it was the first family sedan in a smaller size. And that was the Hal Sperling project. And I worked with Hal on that, and we had many battles, but many triumphs, I think, through that program.
Well, that worked very well. Why would that have not have the Fairmont platform served you for several years? Still is.
We're still using it.
Yeah. Why would that have? What happened to the fact that that Sperling lost favor?
He wanted to go further. His point was that was just the very beginning. that you not only had to do that action, but you had to do it in the smaller below that series, and you also had to bring the big cars down with it. And I think Mr. Ford and a few others thought that you bring out one or two of these and that should be it. You shouldn't have to do them all, and and you can look back now and say they were both right. They were both right.
Iacocca was sort of caught in the middle in that argument, wasn't he? He was a Sperling advocate, and yet he had to please Henry Ford II in terms of design decisions.
Well, from my viewpoint, I didn't see Mr. Iacocca in the middle of that one. He pretty much sided with Mr. Ford. I believe they both agreed that they shouldn't move too quickly. Mm-hmm. It was mostly Bill Burke and Sperling who wanted to downsize. And Lee especially did not want to downsize Lincolns. He was very adamant about keeping a big luxury car. And that if you want to do Falcons and Fairmonts, okay, but don't touch the big ones. So I really don't believe that there was any major problem between them on that one. But I was present in the meeting where the big turnaround in the decision was made when we elected to not downsize. When Mr. Ford left the meeting, and the next day Sperling left the company. But anyway,
that brings you then at this point. You've been assigned the intermediate and compact exterior design office portfolio. Now, did that presage a movement to smaller cars and the company's design
yes,
decisions?
It did. Yeah, that's when we were in full gear into the small car syndrome, and we were just doing everything we could as fast as we could. And we were downsizing and lightening. And maybe downsizing isn't the right word. I think lightening, taking the weight out, is really the correct term we should use. Because sometimes we didn't really shorten or change the dimensions as much as we took the weight out. And here again, as a designer, those were tough times, because those chunks come hard. And we were forced to do a lot of things and doing a lot of investigation and trial and error that many of them didn't work. Some did, some didn't. Some didn't look good. But anyway, those were tough days. But yeah, we went through a busy time in downsizing our small cars.
And trying to hold on until you could get something out on the market.
Hold on until front-wheel drive. See, we didn't have a front-wheel drive package at the time, or front-wheel drive engines, mostly.
You had a transaxle package, though, back in the 60s. You considered it briefly.
Yeah, those
the
were
Cardinal, and then
experimented
later